I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My guest today is Simon Fox, Executive Director of the Adventures in Caring Foundation, a foundation founded in 1984 that works with compassion. He is also co-author of What Can I Say? A Guide to Visiting Friends and Family Who Are Ill, and co-producer of 5 video-based training programs on compassion, including The Medicine of Compassion and Oxygen for Caregivers. For 30 years, Adventures in Caring has taught the art and practice of compassion as a skill that restores well-being and promotes healing. The work is now recognized globally and is more famous for its Raggedy Ann and Andy characters who visit nursing homes and hospitals to lift the spirits of patients who are lonely. Many people still think that compassion cannot be taught, but Karen and Simon have shown this to be incorrect. It can be taught. More than 1,000 hospitals, 1,000 hospices, 2,000 churches, and several hundred nursing schools have used Adventures in Caring programs. Santa Barbara City College School of Nursing has integrated the entire Compassion series into its new Memories Caregiving program that teaches nursing assistants how to build better relationships with patients who have dementia. Visiting Nurses and Hospital Care of Santa Barbara has trained its own team of mentors to teach the Compassion program throughout the entire agency to equip its staff with the most advanced skills for communicating compassion to the sick and dying. Even the American Trauma Society in Washington, D.C. uses their expertise to help teach trauma surgeons how to better communicate with the families of the trauma victims in those crucial moments when they must deliver news right after surgery. In addition to teaching healthcare providers to be more compassionate, Adventures in Caring created the Oxygen for Caregiver program to protect the health and emotional well-being of healthcare professionals. Additional information is available at adventuresincaring.org. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Simon, and I look forward to hearing about compassion. Now, first, how did Adventures in Caring begin?
Well, thanks for having me on, Carl. I really appreciate it. Yeah, Adventures in Caring. We've been doing this for quite some time. My wife began the program 32 years ago, 1984. She first began this work of essentially, it's an experiment, really, on the healing power of love. Mm-hmm. And does it have an effect? And if so, how do you make that a consistent, reliable asset in helping people heal? And so I did not know Karen then. I met her about a year and a half or so later. But Karen's a cancer survivor, like yourself, and she'd lived her life in many countries. Her dad was in the State Department, so she grew up in Ethiopia mostly, as well as Iraq and Italy. And as a result, she got to learn how to interact with all kinds of people, you know, different faiths, different languages, different cultures. On top of that, she's had health challenges her whole life, so she knows full well what it's like to be a patient in the hospital and elsewhere. And she's had many life-threatening illnesses besides cancer. So she's had a real tough go of it, but she really understood what's going on in a patient's mind when they're ill. And it's more than just the medical treatment. That there's an emotional need to connect with people because pain is very isolating. And even if you have a room full of people and still feel very, very alone facing what you're facing. So she decided to do something about it, and Karen worked for doctors also, as ran the office. In those days, she did a bit of, you know, wore many hats, helped with the surgeries, did all kinds of things. And so one day before she was getting things ready for the afternoon appointments with the doctors, and her phone rings, and it's her personal physician, not the one she worked for, but it's her personal physician. And he said, look, we've got the test back, and it's in that area you had cancer before, and they don't look good. So can you come in? Let's talk about it. Well, as you know, getting news like that in the middle of the day, out of the blue, is disheartening at least. So she was, you know, basically really demoralized by hearing that news. And at the same time, the physician that she worked for walked in the door and wanted to know what the appointments were for the afternoon. So she's trying to compose herself after hearing this potentially very bad news.
Mm-hmm.
She looks down at her desk to avoid all eye contact with the physician she works for. And she sees this magazine face down on her desk, and on it, it was a medical magazine. It had a pharmaceutical ad on the back. And it was a doctor with a little girl, and she had a rag doll in her hand. And it was just pure inspiration. It brought back memories of her childhood and how comforting that doll was for her when she was sick. And she said to the doctor, she just looked straight up at him and said, Larry, what about this? What if I dressed up as Raggedy Ann? And I walked into the hospital across the street from our office on my lunch hours and visited patients who had no other visitors. And the doctor is a very conservative, older doctor, very well respected in our area. And he looked at it and said, well, Karen, I think it's a great idea. Why don't you call the hospital right now? I'll back you up on this. And so she did. And they said, okay, well, we need to run it by some people and various committees, but we'll get back to you. And so that happened, and then she put the phone down and thought, oh, my goodness, what did I just sign up for here, you know? Because she's not an extrovert. She'd never even dressed for Halloween in her life. And so this was a major stretch for her to do this, but she started doing it. And really, it was that moment when she began this. Well, actually, that was in about September 83. It took until February the next year for the hospital to finally figure out that, okay, we'll give you permission to do this on these particular units, on these particular days, and we'll watch you carefully and see what effect it has. And so she did, and they were amazed. She actually began on Valentine's Day, 1984. That was the first day in the hospital. And she had some major visits with patients that were quite miraculous. As in, people with throat cancer who hadn't spoken months spoke to her, you know, a person. You know, things like that that she just took as the sign that this was a work that she was supposed to continue. And anyway, so she continued to visit each day on her lunch hours and got remarkable results from the patients. The nurses noticed, and so they were very happy to have her there. You know, patients who were very agitated or upset got calmed down. Those who were depressed got uplifted. They were seeing them discharged from the hospital sooner, things like that. And so word got around. Santa Barbara's a small town, and word got around. People started asking, wow, we'd like to do this. Can you show us how? And that was about the time I met Karen, after she'd been doing this for a while, and other people were coming along and saying, can you show us how to do this? And the question was then, is this a gift that she has? Well, clearly it is, but can it be transferred? Can it be taught? And I'm sure you know, Carl, in your career, there are gifted doctors, there are gifted nurses, there are gifted therapists who have that knack of making a profound connection with the people in their care. And there are those that don't. And so it's like, well, can that knack be taught? Or is it some people are gifted, some people are not, and that's the end of it? And so that's when I started working with Karen, because my background is not in healthcare at all. My background is in physics. I've been working in aerospace and things like that. And fortunately, I've been very blessed with good health, so I'd never been in a hospital except the day I was born. So I, a few trips to the emergency room as a kid for various scrapes and scratches and stuff. But other than that, no. So I wasn't familiar with healthcare and how it was worked, and I certainly did not have the skills that Karen did. But I was fascinated by what she was accomplishing. And so I heard about it first, and then I said, well, can I tag along with you? And she said, sure. And I would see her going to a room, somebody who's got leukemia, dying of leukemia, very painfully in those days. And she'd be in there 10, 15 minutes. And after that, about 10 minutes into the visit, they're cracking jokes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're having this lively conversation. And I was there. I saw it happen. But I was still wondering, how the heck did that just happen? Why would somebody open up to her? You know, why would they be in a good mood knowing what they're dealing with? And how did all that suddenly change? And so I became, you know, I guess it was the physicist in me that was curious about what are the dynamics of the situation? And then the question about, well, can this be taught? So I actually, Karen and I started working together and to see if we could develop a training program. And I'd done that in the aerospace business. I started working with management because their problem was communication with each other, not just solving aerospace problems. And so I had some training experience, and I thought, well, wow, I wonder if we can create something like this. So I followed her around for months with a yellow pad in my hand making notes, and then we'd debrief afterwards, and we'd try and see, you know, what are the essential ingredients that make these conversations work, and what is it that helps the patient experience compassion? Because we really looked at compassion as, you know, it's compassion when the other person gets it that you care. You know, you might have nice, warm feelings in your own heart. That's all good. But can you transfer it to them? And so that they realize, oh, you're in my corner. You know, you're truly with me in this, through this. And that's really how we define compassion. Really, it was going back to the Latin root of the word, compati. You know, com meaning together, with, and pati means to feel intensely or to suffer. So we see this as the art of being with someone who's suffering. And how can you authentically be present with them?
Then, Simon, can compassion be taught?
Well, that's what we set out to discover. Can compassion be taught? Because we honestly didn't know. And it wasn't, we didn't have some pre-organized or pre-idea of like some philosophy we wanted to promote or anything like that. We just wanted to find out. We had volunteers who wanted to learn. And Karen knew how. We just needed to figure out, well, can we show these new people what she's doing, and can they then do it? So that's why I followed her around. We did a lot of debriefing, and eventually four core principles started to emerge as these are always present. And it wasn't just Karen, but any nurse or doctor or health professional who was good at connecting with the patients, they were also doing these same things. Instinctively, usually, not consciously, just they just naturally do these things all day long without thinking about it. So we tried to do, we pulled them out and then taught them discreetly in a experiential training session where people role-played and they practiced. They actually got time with adults. Karen used the character Raggedy Ann because she wanted to present a safe character to someone who was going through an illness and someone who was clearly announcing that this is a non-medical conversation. Because everybody else who's walking in that door is a nurse, a doctor, a lab tech, housekeeping, somebody to do with the hospital. And Karen wanted to announce, this is a non-medical conversation, and this is safe. It's safe in that it's confidential. It's safe in I'm not going to deliver any bad news. It's safe that I'm not going to prod or poke or make you do anything uncomfortable. And so a patient could relax and talk about what they really wanted to talk about. And so that's why we use the character. And plus, the metaphor, the symbolism of being dressed in rags is conveys, I'm in a humble place here like you are. Because the patient is usually wearing a silly hospital gown, open in the back, and things like that. And they're not feeling like they've got their A game going either. So there's a certain kind of solidarity with the patient that is never spoken, is just felt because of the way they appear.
Mm-hmm.
And so creates this unique kind of conversation. But one day, how we knew that this was successfully being taught, at first anecdotally, which was nurses would come up to Karen, and one particular incident, a nurse who knew her well said, "Thanks for being on the unit yesterday. I'm really glad you visited Mr. So-and-so. He's been a bear all week. He's made life on this unit absolutely miserable. He's yelled at the nurses. He's thrown things at them. People, they're scared to go in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's very insulting, and it's just miserable. But ever since you visited him yesterday, he's been a different person.
Mm-hmm.
He's apologized to the nurses. He's realized that he was totally out of line, and he's tried to make amends. And so things are pretty much back to normal here, so thanks for seeing him." And Karen said, "Well, I appreciate that, thanks. However, it wasn't me. It was one of my new volunteers." And that's when we knew, these skills are transferring. These skills are giving our volunteers the ability to deal with even very difficult patients,
mm-hmm.
and a change happens. We call it the alchemy of compassion. There's this change that happens as a result,
mm-hmm.
That can be seen. And when you make that connection with somebody, it is visibly different.
Mm-hmm.
When they realize that you care, the body language changes. It could be as simple as a smile, but it could be a deeper breath. Coloring of their skin changes because their peripheral blood system opens up a little more because they're less under threat. All kinds of small, subtle, but observable changes as a result when somebody realizes, oh, here's somebody who gets me. Here's somebody who understands what I'm going through and will listen.
Mm-hmm. And you've chosen to work with future healthcare providers?
We have. In the early days, back in the mid and late 80s, we had all age groups involved in our program. The youngest we had was 16, and the oldest was, I think, 86,
mm-hmm.
everything in between. But as we went forward, the demographics of our community changed. It was more difficult for people who were mid-career to volunteer. And at the same time, we got more and more interest from university students. Our local university, University of California, Santa Barbara,
mm-hmm.
and especially the young men and women there who are studying to go into the health professions. So they're studying whatever they need to study to go into either medical school or nursing school, nursing graduate school, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they heard about us, and first we had a handful volunteering, and they came more and more and more because they got just as much out of it as they gave.
Mm-hmm.
And they're bright, young people who are doing well in school, but they realize they're not learning in school everything they're going to need to know to be a good nurse, a good doctor, a good healthcare professional, because they're not learning the emotional side of it or the communication side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted real practice with real patients and learn real skills on how to do this. And by volunteering with us, they could gain that. And so our volunteer program really morphed into a service learning program,
mm-hmm.
where the service is still volunteering, but it has a stronger and stronger learning component. And it's a win-win program, so that we serve the patients in our area and the local hospitals and skilled nursing units, but we also have this whole new generation of our future nurses and doctors are being taught this art,
mm-hmm.
of how do you treat the people in your care with compassion? What mm-hmm. is compassion? How do you convey it to others?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they gain, not from a lecture, but from actual practice.
Mm-hmm.
They have to volunteer for us for at least a year, every week. Well, every school year on mm-hmm. school weeks. And the reason for that is, yes, it's for our organization because it's hard to put. We put a lot of time and effort and training
mm-hmm.
into these young people. So if they only volunteered a time or two, we couldn't sustain
right.
that.
But right.
but by them volunteering for at least a year, we know after 6 or 8 months, it's under their belt. It's in their bones.
Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, our goal was to have it in their bones so strong that it would survive medical school.
Mm-hmm.
Which tends to be tough on these young people.
Right.
And we've succeeded at that because now we have, 20-year-olds who volunteered with us 20 years ago, mm-hmm. are in their 40s, right? And they're teaching their students now the mm-hmm. skills they learned through this program.
And how do you teach compassion?
Well, we have an entire process we use. It can't be taught by lecture,
mm-hmm.
just by studying best practices or something like that. What we've learned is the first thing we have to do is make it visible, because compassion is this invisible, nebulous thing, and everybody's got their own version of what they think it is. So we define it very carefully, like I just did, mm-hmm. you know, the Latin root of it and this kind of thing, and what we mean by it. And then we make it visible. We actually shot video of not staged, but actual real staff dealing with real patients on a real day and looking for those golden moments when that compassionate connection is made. Some people call them caring moments, but there's a palpable sense of here we are together in this. And people can really feel that. And what's interesting is you can feel it when it's shown on video.
Mm-hmm.
And so we essentially teach by pointing at first, where we put it on the mm-hmm. screen and hear, and people get it. Whatever word they've used for that experience, they get what that is. And so they were clear on what people are pointing at. And then we use a lot of group dialogue, because everybody brings something to the table on this. Everybody has had some experiences of compassion or the lack of it,
mm-hmm.
and what the consequences of that are. And so we use wisdom in the room. We use a lot of reflection, because building reflection and the capacity to reflect and build self-awareness is crucial to this. You can't do it without it. And then there's obviously practice, which is out getting out there and actually visiting people. And they do it at first under the wing of an experienced volunteer,
mm-hmm.
who would then we come back and they're coached on what, you know, their strengths, what they're mm-hmm. doing well, and mm-hmm. also their areas for improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody gets personal coaching. We don't train more than about 13 to 14 at a time. So that everybody gets personal coaching, not just once, but at three different mm-hmm. times during a training. So we start with very thorough training, mm-hmm. very thorough. And then when they're assigned their various units that they visit on a weekly basis, they only visit for usually about 2 hours in the hospital or skilled nursing unit. There's no quota for number of patients. But they're also not just expected not to just to visit, but to write about it,
mm-hmm.
submit their journals to us. We can read the journals and get a sense of their level of insight into what's going on by what they put on the page, and then we can coach them based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that each week they're going through this process, and they're feeding back to us, and we can feed back to them when necessary. And they gradually learn through experience and feedback these skills.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just we don't install, you know, compassion 3.0 or something.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably more accurate to say we cultivate it in
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
We take what's already there and we cultivate it. We found that flame. Mm-hmm. So you asked, how do we teach compassion?
Mm-hmm.
That's how we go about it. It's very mm-hmm. thorough. It's more thorough than anything. I know there's beginning to make good strides in medical school to bring this subject up and address it. But I don't know anybody who does a course as thoroughly as mm-hmm. we do.
And can everyone learn this?
Good question. I think everyone has room for improvement, and everybody can improve. There are some people who are tough nuts to crack,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
it's not our job to try and convince the skeptics. We mm-hmm. want people who are of good heart and want to learn. We can help them get better and develop real skill in
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like any skill. If somebody wants to dig their heels in and refuse to learn, then I don't care what skill it is. They're not going to learn
mm-hmm.
it. But it is a learnable skill, and we've had students from all countries and races and languages, and because we get quite an international group of students out of the local university here, and they've all been, even the most shy and reserved and folks you think would, they're almost scared to death of to meet somebody who's outside their peer group,
mm-hmm.
we've shown them how to succeed at this,
mm.
and after 6 or 8 months, they're a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing is is quite advanced communication-wise. I mean, they're young people, they're learning to communicate with people who are four or five times their age, who probably grew up in a different country, often speaking a different language, believing a different faith, coming at life from a completely different angle, and they'll find something they've got in common with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they learn how to do that, and that's part of this art of connecting with compassion, is finding things you've got in common. Even people who you think your world's apart, you can find that place where you connect. And so they manage to do that, and even though these people are not only very different the way they grew up, but they're also hearing impaired, or they've had a stroke, or they're very injured or very ill, and they're in a lot of pain, and they can still make that connection.
Mm-hmm.
So for young people to develop these skills right at the front end of their career is a profound thing, because it will stay with them their entire life. And from then on, mm-hmm. every patient in their care for their whole career
mm-hmm.
will be treated that way, because it becomes... It's not a technique. It becomes how they do medicine or how mm-hmm. they do nursing. It just becomes part of who they are. And that's what we're most mm-hmm. pleased about, is that it can be passed from generation to generation
mm-hmm.
when we do it this way.
Is there any discipline that is more interested than another?
Well, it depends what you mean by discipline.
I mean like doctors versus nurses versus... I don't know what other kind of people you...
Yeah, well, like, I mean, it's like the students at the university, they all think they're going to be pre-med, right? They all think they're pre-med. And then they find out, well, maybe not, you know. and so they go, you know what, I think I'm going to be a physician's assistant or mm-hmm. nurse practitioner or mm-hmm. physical therapist or go into psychology or something like that. And so we end up... teaching an entire range of, mm-hmm. of future health professionals, most of whom don't really know right up front where they're going to end up. So that's, I mean, mm-hmm. what I'm describing is the volunteer side mm-hmm. of what we do. We also have professional staff training that evolved out of this volunteer work.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, I would say nurses are by far our biggest mm-hmm. audience. By far.
I would have thought that.
Yeah, both nurses in practice and mm-hmm. also nurses in academia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the nursing schools, in fact, that's how we started doing work for professional staffs. We created a video. We were asked,
mm-hmm.
after a while we got asked, how do you teach your volunteers how to do this? This is amazing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you teach them that? And so we wrote a book about it called What Can I Say? People can find that on our website,
mm-hmm.
Which is all about how do you... It's called a guide to visiting friends and family who are ill, and we created that for a volunteer audience. And then other volunteer groups like hospice volunteers and
mm-hmm.
hospital auxiliary volunteers, ASTAs, and church caregiving committees and people like that, they asked us, wow, can you come teach our people... Well, because of Karen's health situation, she couldn't run around the country teaching
mm-hmm.
people. So we had to see, well, what could we create that we can essentially put in the mail, and so they can do it themselves, and they could have a group meeting, and they could learn these skills. And we eventually realized that video was the best medium to use,
mm-hmm.
because you can simply point to it. And when you do, when you point to a good example, people get it.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes something, this nebulous, invisible thing, and it makes it visible, and everybody has this aha moment about what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, and plus, it makes it more actionable. They can see, oh, this is doable. This is possible. So we shot video, and what happened was, even though we shot the video for a volunteer audience, some nurses got a hold of it and started using it in teaching their classes in some nursing schools.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got back to us and said, we love your video. This is fantastic, but it would really help if we could show professionals in action doing this. So we went out in another 2 or 3, 4 year project
mm-hmm.
and created another video showing professional staffs using these same skills.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when we started the professional side of what we do. That's gone over very well, and that's been very popular with nurses. In fact, our latest production, Oxygen for Caregivers, which is all about how nurses and healthcare professionals protect themselves from compassion fatigue and burnout and moral distress and things like that, that's just been adopted by ELNIC, which is the End of Life Nursing Educators Consortium.
Mm.
And they're an international group of nurse educators, teach all over the world, hospice and palliative care.
Mm-hmm.
And they've adopted our latest program as their self-care module.
Mm.
And so we're very proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
I just presented in about six major conferences in North America, but also in China, Kenya, and Romania last year,
mm-hmm.
Because their nurses are struggling too. And so we were very honored that they would take our work and plug it right into their already world-class program.
Mm-hmm.
And so nurses have played a huge role in the development of this effort. They really have. Well, obviously, we have nurses on our board of directors, on our advisors,
mm-hmm.
and dear friends, and it's mm-hmm. been a team effort.
Now, you talk about self-compassion and that your organization evolved from teaching compassion to teaching both compassion and self-compassion. Can you tell us what is self-compassion and why you felt that was necessary?
Sure. It evolved out of a volunteer program like everything else we've done. We have these students who are volunteering with us. They're mm-hmm. great young people. I mean, they make a commitment to volunteer with us for a year, but most of them volunteer for at least 2, 3, sometimes 4 because they get so much out of it. So we get to know them well over those years because they come back and they don't just volunteer. They help with teaching new volunteers, and we get to know them very well. And they started coming to us and saying, you know, we're excited about career in healthcare, really want to do this. But I've met doctors and leaders in healthcare, you know, 20, 30 years ahead of me on the career path, and they are burned out,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to go there. I want to do this noble work. I don't want to burn out.
Mm-hmm.
How do I not burn out? So we started to hear this over and over, and we thought, well, you know what? That is an honest question, and you know, it deserves an honest answer. It really does. I mean, prior to that, they'd asked us, you know, how do you teach compassion? The second one was, how do you teach compassion? How do you convey compassion to difficult patients?
Mm-hmm.
So we did a video on that, addressing, you know, those awkward, difficult, embarrassing, nasty, you know, situations that healthcare providers find themselves in. And we dealt with that. And then the next question was, how do I not burn out?
Mm-hmm.
That's why we went down that road. We didn't have an answer ready. We went looking, and we went to, like we always do, we kept it real. As far as you know, trying to identify the best practices, we went and interviewed healthcare professionals and professionals in emergency services. Anybody who sees human suffering firsthand comes up against this, and we thought, okay, those are the guys we need to talk to. And especially those who've been in their career for a good long time, and they're thriving. What are they doing? That's what we were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And as we began doing that project, the first thing that hit us in the face was like, well, wait a minute. These are dedicated people. They're highly educated people. They really care. And they know full well how to look after themselves. They're not stupid. They know exactly what to do. But they're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the question. So it wasn't so much what mm-hmm. is the method, but what are these choices that they're making that really are not serving them well? And why is that? So that the project developed along those lines. And again, like our earlier work, we found it best taught in a team setting.
Mm-hmm.
So that even though you could say, well, it's about self-care, we realize self-care is not just about you.
Mm-hmm.
It's about your relationships with others, which have a tremendous impact on your own well-being, and vice versa, you on theirs. So that's why we went down that road. And as the further we went down that road, the more serious we realized the problem was.
Mm-hmm.
Compassion fatigue was identified and termed, named rather, probably by around the mid-90s by a man called Charles Figley. And he identified it as it's an emotional exhaustion, which is different from burnout. Burnout is more to do with the work you do and being physically and mentally tired from it, and also the work environment, not getting support and, you know, working long hours and lousy job conditions and things like that. Whereas compassion fatigue is more coming up against human suffering and giving and giving and giving and giving and giving and giving more and until you just don't have anything to give.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's this deep emotional exhaustion that it's tough to recover from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, burnout you can actually fix by changing your job,
mm-hmm.
getting a different situation. Compassion fatigue, not so. That's something you personally have to spend time recovering from. So we started to understand deeper and deeper the issues and the problems. The irony is that healthcare professionals are in poorer physical and mental health than other occupations.
Mm-hmm.
And so our whole focus was, like, well, what's with that? And then you look, you know, nurses, they're more likely to experience on-the-job violence than all other professions. You've got about a third of them get assaulted every year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's more than police officers, more than firefighters, more than, you know, more than anybody. And then nursing assistants, they get injured more often than any other occupation. They're more likely to be injured on the job than construction workers.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, wow, wait a minute, this is big. And then we went around all the other specialties, you know, palliative care workers. You know, their stress scores are higher than patients who've just been newly diagnosed with breast cancer. You know, and then you got trauma workers and your physicians and your surgeons. I mean, surgeon suicide rates are out the roof. And first responders, they get assaulted. Even social workers do. Third-year medical students, you know, you've got half of them reporting burnout. I mean, this is a huge personal and societal cost. I mean, you've got these bright, idealistic, dedicated people, the very kind of people you want delivering healthcare,
mm-hmm.
and we're trashing them, you know? And so it's like, well, what can we do? And how can we at least take a fresh look at this situation? And that's what our new program is all about. We called it Oxygen for Caregivers because it's just like on the airplanes, you know, put your oxygen on you first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got oxygen to your brain, you make better decisions that way. And that's the way we approach this course. We're not telling people what to do. We're helping them think more clearly about their own self-care, their own wellness, their own sense of balance and things like that. And so that's what these are the ideas we wove into the program. But we found that the most insidious thing about burnout is that it's isolating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When people start to burn out, they start to become less and less social. They're the people who fade into the woodwork in the back of the room. You know, they don't want people paying attention to them, and yet everybody knows there's something kind of wrong, but they're not around as much anymore. And those are the people you're losing. And so with team teaching, you know, teaching this not just by yourself, but sitting down, watching something together, sparking a conversation, getting a conversation out on the table, you know, getting it spoken of is the first step.
Mm-hmm.
And not in a moaning and groaning and whining manner, but in a sensible manner, you know, that is like, no, this is an issue. Let's talk about this. So that's how we went down that road.
Mm. Do you see that this has been a change? Because burnout is a relatively new concept. And I remember when I was working in the hospitals, and this was back in the 50s, you know, the interns, for example, used to be on call Friday evening, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. And then they were on call. You know, if they weren't on for the weekend, then they were on several days during the week. Well, that must have been exhausting, and I don't know how much support they got, you know, from
right.
their superiors. And yet, you never heard of burnout. It's a relatively new concept. the same as the post-traumatic stress syndrome. I know that it maybe it just was overlooked because I remember my brother in the Second World War came back and he used to wake up in the night screaming. And there was they never talked about, they never offered any services or anything for this. So I'm wondering if some of this has always been around, but it's just never been identified and has never had any services provided for it?
Right. I think it is overlooked, and sometimes deliberately because of institutional bias and institutional abuse that gets passed on from generation to generation, and people keep quiet about it.
Mm-hmm.
But working, you know, like you say, the interns, the way they were worked was very, very tough.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you had tough people there, and I admire everybody who dealt with it and did incredibly amazing work, despite that.
Well, I used to, if I was on the weekend, I would try to handle everything I could handle myself. About the only thing was if someone fell out of bed or if we got an admission, then I'd have to call. But other than that, I'd try to handle everything I could because I felt that I would not want to go through what they were going through in that situation.
Right. Yeah, it's a careful balancing act, and mm-hmm. we don't want to the purpose of our program is not to point mm-hmm. fingers and say this is wrong or but it's to let's just say that, you know, bitter, burned out mm-hmm. caregivers cannot be a source of comfort to anybody.
Right, right. I agree.
So if we want patients to be treated with compassion, which is what our mission is about, what we've realized is we got to look after the caregivers too.
Mm-hmm.
Because in other words, it's two-way street.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the old provider-consumer model where the caregivers are continually supposed to provide and provide and provide, and consumers just simply consume and consume and consume.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a one-way street to burnout.
Right.
Where we need to create this better, healthier ebb and flow where
mm-hmm.
both, you know, we deal with compassion fatigue, but we also work on compassion satisfaction,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is the joy you get from helping people heal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got this healthy balance of give and take versus this, like the industrial assembly line model
mm-hmm.
of it, which
mm-hmm.
sucks the heart and soul out of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Simon, we're getting close to the end, so at this, did want to ask you about scientific data. Is there scientific data that supports your program?
Increasingly so, yes. I mean, compassion is now being seriously studied by
mm-hmm.
major universities like especially Stanford
mm-hmm.
and UCLA, and they're starting to see it is through the fight or flight response,
mm-hmm.
essentially. I mean, in its most mundane terms, compassion reduces stress
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because people don't feel so alone, and people are threatened when they feel alone. And so compassion is a way of bringing hope to the situation. It's a way of defeating that social isolation that is so damaging. I mean, speaking of research,
mm-hmm.
Social isolation is found to be a bigger healthcare risk than smoking 15 cigarettes a day
mm-hmm.
and more dangerous than alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
So social isolation is a huge risk. Well, what's the medicine for that? There isn't one. The medicine is a human being showing up and knowing how to listen and connect with
mm-hmm.
So that's some of the research. But I think Stephen Cole at UCLA, the geneticist, is doing some amazing research showing how the presence of compassion reduces the gene responses that trigger inflammation
mm-hmm.
and other immune responses. So we're starting to see that human connectedness
mm-hmm.
that compassion helps create is essential to health and well-being. It goes back to primal and evolutionary
mm-hmm.
reasons. I mean, we have that fundamental need to connect with others.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, even the neurotransmitters and the stress hormones are affected by good listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Gilbert and, like I said, Stephen Cole, I mean, Paul Ekman's work on emotions, all of that, there's some really solid stuff starting to come out. Of course, compassion, obviously, is a very subtle thing to be able to discern, does it or does it not affect.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But gradually, some high-quality work is being done, and the Stanford website has got a very good source of it, and so is the Schwartz Center website.
Oh, mm-hmm. I can see the benefits to the patient of the compassion, which is some of the things you mentioned. Are there benefits to the person who is compassionate? You know, you think of forgiveness helps the person that forgives.
Right.
Whereas compassion tends to more help the person who is receiving. Is that right?
Actually, like I said, it's a two-way street. There is that compassion for satisfaction. Some of the research uses the term exquisite empathy.
Oh.
Where it's the satisfaction of helping someone else heal or get stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an incredibly meaningful experience. Stephen Post over at Stony Brook University, he's done a lot of work on this, sponsored by the Templeton Foundation, and on the volunteer high and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's why our volunteers, we mm-hmm. ask for a one-year commitment, and they give us two or three.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they do that?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're getting something out of this, a
mm-hmm.
lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not getting credit for this.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it because they care, but because they're growing as people.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you more human.
Right.
I mean, when you're encountering, as people in healthcare do, they encounter a lot of tragic circumstances. They come face to face with human suffering a lot. And that can either make you more wooden and defensive and aloof, or if you engage in the right way, it can make you more human.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a deeper, wiser perspective on life. You learn from them about life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of it. So in many ways, it is alchemy. You're taking
mm-hmm.
something,
mm-hmm.
a leaden, heavy experience, and you're turning it into something valuable, something golden.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so. To answer your question, does mm-hmm. the caregiver get something out? Absolutely, they do.
Mm-hmm.
You're not just delivering services; you're being with somebody and going on this journey together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we called our organization Adventures in Caring Foundation,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because it's caring not just as a task, but caring as an adventure,
mm-hmm.
where it's a path of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Is going into the unknown together and learning more about life as a result.
Is this a foundation?
This is a nonprofit organization.
Okay, good. And so you said that it's volunteer, but you still have to have funding. And so do you do fundraising, or is there fundraising on your site, or how does all of that work?
Yeah, we're entirely privately supported. We're not supported by the government or by a university or by a hospital or anybody. We're doing this on the goodwill of people who donate, and small family foundations in our area
mm-hmm.
have been very
mm-hmm.
good to us. And actually, our educational videos that we produced, we sell those.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we raise funds, and it's tough to do, as you know. You
right,
all know.
Yep, right.
But you know, every year we've got like 90 to 100 young people who are learning these skills through
mm-hmm.
our program. So those scholarships, I mean, mm-hmm. we invest a lot in these young people,
mm-hmm.
and we give them skills that last a lifetime. But it takes staff, it takes volunteers, it takes
right.
office and organization and all that good stuff.
Right.
So if your listeners would love to get behind this, find out more about it, get involved in some way, I welcome that. I really do.
And can you give us the website?
The website is adventuresincaring.org.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a special offer on there. I think if any of your listeners want to email me directly,
mm-hmm.
I'm happy
mm-hmm.
for them to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in my email address is simon@adventuresincaring.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be happy to send them the little booklet I mentioned. What Can I Say? A Guide to Visiting Friends and Family Who Are Ill. I can send them a PDF of that. And if they have any interest in our either our volunteer training
mm-hmm.
or our professional staff training, I'd be happy to share what I know.
Great. And can you tell us then a little bit about your book? We're almost out of time, but I wanted you to mention your books.
The book, What Can I Say? It's just a little book that fits in handily in a back pocket. And we know that family members especially are nervous about going to see a loved one in the hospital. And because they're always wondering, you know, what do I say? How do I act?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, and so, the result of that is because they're nervous, they often don't go. But that's exactly the time when their family member who is in the hospital needs them to go.
Mm-hmm.
We all need each other to get through those tough places in life. So this little book is essentially a book of encouragement, but it's a very practical guide
mm-hmm.
of, you know, what to say, what not to say, but more than that, how to approach the whole thing in such a way that it's a positive experience for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And you really can learn how to do this. The most effective way is to dive in and try it. You know, go on that adventure
mm-hmm.
and, you know, step outside your comfort zone and take a risk. And go in and interact.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly it's about taking an interest in what they are interested in.
Mm-hmm. And your book is available on your website and like
it is.
Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And
it's available on Amazon,
mm-hmm.
And it's available on our website.
Mm-hmm. Great. Good. And would you give us the website again?
Sure. The website is www.adventuresincaring.org.
Great. Well, I appreciate this very much, Simon. As I told you, the compassion is a very important concept and practice, I believe. And there aren't too many people that are into this yet. And so it was great to find
yep.
you and to get the opportunity to talk with you about it.
Thank you, Carl. No, I'm very glad. Yes, we've been doing this for 32 years, and
mm-hmm.
I'm glad more and more people are starting to realize the power of this,
mm-hmm.
because we all have a role to play in the healing process, and we may not have a medical education, but we can communicate compassion to one another, and that can make all the difference in the world. So,
right.
So I really appreciate you having me on, Carl. I really do.
Great. Thank you. I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show. And I hope some of the information will be useful to you. I invite you to my websites, holistichealthshow.com, where you will find all shows for the past 7 years under the blog. You will also find much of the research on natural ways to deal with cancer and other health conditions, and can sign up for my free monthly newsletter. On my website, BeatLungCancer.net, you will find many of the 135 interviews from radio and television over the past 2 years about my book on treating lung cancer naturally and holistically when I was diagnosed 41 years ago next month and given 6 months to live by traditional medicine who offered chemo and surgery. This book was published in November 2012 and was a bestseller on Amazon. You will find endorsements of the book, a place to buy the book, and an earlier one from 2007 titled Healthy Holistic Aging, A Blueprint for Success. On my third website, you will find information on the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation, begun last year and currently in the phase of completing the website. This site is at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. Information on how the foundation differs from others, board members, research on holistic natural ways to deal with cancer, including mental and spiritual interventions, interviews with cancer physicians and survivors, and more. If you would like to donate to the work I am supporting, there is a tab to donate, and I can offer you a tax exemption receipt if living in the United States. I also invite you to join me on Facebook at my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Carl Helvey, on my Holistic Health Show page at www.facebook.com/pages/Holistic Health Show, and the Carl O. Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation page at www.facebook.com/beatlungcancernaturalalternative. On LinkedIn, I invite you to join me under my name, Dr. Carl O. Helvey. On Twitter, I invite you to join me at www.twitter.com/HolistHealthShow, HolistHealthShow. I wish you a great week, and I look forward to having you here in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O. Helvey, your host.